Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in chapter 49 of Genesis. I'm only going to do the first half or so of that chapter, verses 1 through 18. Jacob blesses his sons. That's going to be part A. Part B will be in our next audio. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Genesis 48, Joseph has blessed his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Jacob has blessed Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And that takes care of two of the patriarchs. And now he's going to bless the rest of his sons, starting in this first half of chapter 49. We start with verses 1 and 2. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, remember now, they're all in Egypt. Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Now when he says, I may tell you what will befall you, this is going to be as much a prophecy as it is a blessing, as we'll see as we go through here. Verse 2, gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Now, Genesis 49, verses 2 through 27 is called the quote-unquote blessing of Jacob. It's the longest poem in Genesis. Its blessings are not only intended for Jacob's sons, but for all the tribes that come after Jacob's sons, descendants. Here's what Adam Clark says. It is evident from this, and indeed from the whole complexion of these important prophecies, that the 12 sons of Jacob had very little concern in them, personally considered, as they were to be fulfilled in the last days, i.e. in times remote from that period, and consequently to their posterity, and not to themselves or to their immediate families. Now, when Clark says last days, he doesn't mean at the end of time. He basically means what in any day after the patriarchs die. Some of these fulfillments took place when Israel was in Canaan. Other times were fulfilled in the time of Messiah when Jesus came the first time. We go now to verses 3 and 4, Genesis 49. Jacob continues, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Now, it's kind of interesting. He says, Reuben, you're preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, but you will not have preeminence. Well, he was preeminent. He should have been preeminent because of his status, because he was the firstborn. Usually the firstborn get the double portion, and the double portion means twice the amount of wealth that the other sons inherit and the right to head the family, the clan. Now, we see that Reuben is the firstborn in 1 Chronicles 5:1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. The birthright was given to Ephraim and Manasseh. We did that in the last chapter. This is recorded in 1 Chronicles 5. He defiled his father's bed. That's when he took Bilhah, Jacob, his father's concubine, and had sex with her, and that was making a premature claim to the inheritance. Bad enough, the sexual immorality, but also there was money involved. So Reuben, he blew it. He's gone. Uncontrolled as water. Well, first of all, let's look in verse 3. Jacob says, Reuben, you are my might in the beginning of my strength. That is a phrase that was later put in Deuteronomy by Moses. Deuteronomy 21, verse 17. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion for all of all that he has, for he is the beginning of strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. This is a provision dealing with polygamy. If the firstborn, if there are two wives, one loved and one unloved, and the unloved has the firstborn, well, by golly, the firstborn still gets the double portion. Why? For he is the beginning of his strength. Strength, of course, refers to the offspring. That's the strength of a man. And the beginning of his strength means that he's the firstborn child. The rest of the children will be strength, but the firstborn is the beginning of the strength. Same phrase, kind of a strange phrase. We don't use that. Now in verse 4, Reuben is said to be uncontrolled as water. The NIV has turbulent as water. And, of course, that was because of what he did. You went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. That was Bilhah's couch, his concubine. Now, Reuben's descendants are characterized by indecision, and some people say that is what this means, uncontrolled as water. I don't see the connection myself. The metaphor doesn't make sense. Uncontrolled sounds like somebody's passions running out of the channels, and that's why he took Bilhah to the couch, and I think that's what it refers to. But some people say indecision is what the word refers to, And they cite Judges 5:15-16. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. That's Deborah and Barak, the judge, the judges. As was Issachar, so was Barak. Barak was, of course, Deborah's general that went fighting for her. Into the valley they rushed at his, Barak's, heels. Among the divisions of Reuben there was great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping of the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben there was great searchings of heart. In other words, they're thinking about going up there and supporting Barak, but they're not really sure they want to do that. Well, I don't think indecision is Reuben's problem. I think turbulence, uncontrollability is Reuben's problem. Reuben's laying with Bilhah was not very indecisive. It was just lustful and improper. Now, in verse 4, Jacob says, "You shall not have preeminence, Reuben." Now, how was that fulfilled? Remember, these are prophecies. Well, Reuben's posterity was on the other side of the Jordan, not on the west side where all the action was. It was south of Gilead, the southern end of Gilead, and even further south, right north of Moab. Kind of an out-of-the-way place. No persons of any note sprang from his tribe, as Gill and Clark say. The tribe itself of Reuben was not as numerous as one-third as either Judah, Joseph, or Dan. I'm not sure Clark says this. I'm not sure whether he means Ephraim and Manasseh together or Ephraim and Manasseh separately, but let's put it this way. The tribe didn't have a lot of people in it, a third of Judah, a third of Dan. It was among the first of the tribes carried into captivity to the Babylonians. So Reuben was a nothing burger. I hope he enjoyed that night of sex with Bilhah, because he sure paid for it, and his descendants paid for it. We read about that incident, by the way, with Bilhah in Genesis 35, verse 22. It came about while Israel was dwelling in that land, that's Shechem. Excuse me, that was not Shechem. They'd already moved from Shechem down to Bethlehem when Rachel had just died. And then something. Jacob just had his wife die, and then his concubine, the only wife he had left, his junior wife, get shacked up with by his son Reuben. Now that's really, he didn't have a good time then. That was bad. A lot of people speculate that Bilhah remained chaste. He didn't have sex with her anymore after Reuben had done that. And I don't know if that's true or not. But at any rate, that's what happened. Now, why did Jacob address Reuben first here? Because Reuben was the firstborn. It's logical that he would be addressed first. Jacob didn't disinherit Reuben completely. He did take from him the right of the double portion. The double portion was given to, one portion of the double portion was given to Ephraim, and one was given to Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, as we saw in the last chapter. Here's what Gill says about that double portion. It means, quote, excellent dignity, power, and authority in the family, a preeminence over his brethren, a double portion of goods, succession in government, and as is commonly understood, the exercise of the priesthood. In other words, double portion means you get more money, more inheritance, and you get more power, more authority. You can be the priest in the family, you make decisions in the family, and so forth. We now go to Genesis 49, verses 5 through 7. We're going in birth order, Simeon and Levi. Simeon's number 2, Levi's number 3. Reuben was number 1. Those are the first three children of Leah. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. Jacob is the name for Israel, the tribes of Jacob. And scatter them in Israel is just the Hebrew way of repeating what he just said. Disperse in Jacob is the same thing as saying scatter them in Jacob. Or disperse them in Israel. Scatter them in Israel is the same thing as saying disperse them in Israel. Now, why did Jacob even say that Simeon and Levi are brothers? I thought everybody there knew that. Was Jacob referring to the fact that they shared the same mother? Well, Clark suggests that. Gill says no. Could it be that Joseph is referring to the fact that they share the same traits, violence, anger, and cruelty? And everybody study Bible says that. So did Gill, so did Clark, and I think they're right. Because blood brothers are sort of obvious, but he's referring to their violence, the way that they did everything together violently. And of course, it's referring to the revenge on the Shechemites when they raped Simeon and Levi's sister Dinah, when they raped Dinah, and then Simeon and Levi said, okay, well, let's make a deal. We'll let you marry Dinah, preserve her honor, but you need to be circumcised first. So the Shechemites all circumcised themselves, and I think it was the third day at the height of their pain. Levi and Simeon went in there and whacked them. Good mafia style. Jacob was not happy about this. He said, "You've made me odious in the land of Shechem." In verse 5, the text says, "Their swords are implements of violence." That word swords has a Hebrew word whose translation is uncertain, but swords is good enough. "Let my soul not enter into their counsel," Jacob said. That's a pretty sad thing for sons to hear from a dying father. Pretty dramatic, pretty sad. Now here, Jacob exculpates himself from having anything to do with the killing of the Shechemites. He was disgusted with it when it happened. Of course, I'm sure he was sad that they raped his daughter Dinah, but murdering somebody for committing rape is not the way to go. Now, there's an interesting detail here. Jacob says, "Oh, they're violent, they're angry, they kill people, they're awful, and they lamed oxen," which seems kind of a anticlimactic afterthought. The NIV has hamstrung, the hamstrung oxen. That was because not only did Simeon and Levi kill the Shechemites, they also destroyed their property. And why not mention that? Because destroying property can be very bad too, if it's your property being destroyed. Now, what's the punishment for all this anger and killing? "I will disperse them in Jacob." Now, of course, that's not Jacob that's going to disperse them in Jacob. That's not going to happen until the land is distributed unto Joshua a couple hundred years later. This is a curse that's actually fulfilled later in history, according to Ellicott and Kyle and Delitch. Now, how was the tribe of Simeon dispersed all through the tribe of Judah? Well, we'll see that in Joshua 19:1. "Then the second lot fell to Simeon." This is when Joshua's drawing lots to see who gets what land, what tribe gets what land. "The second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah." So Simeon didn't have a tribe of his own. He just had some cities scattered throughout the tribe of Judah. Dropping down to Joshua 19:9, "The inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance." So, as Ellicott says, in the wilderness, the Simeonites dwindled from 59,300 to 22,200 men. Starting from that first census to the last census in Numbers, their numbers went down, and then after they got into Canaan, they were so feeble as to have only 15 towns assigned them. Those towns were scattered about in the territory of Judah, and there they melted away, being either absorbed into the tribe among whom they dwelt, absorbed into the tribe of Judah, or withdrawing to wander as nomads in the wilderness of Paran. Well, so there was justice for Simeon's murder. Now, it's a little bit different with Levi. Levi didn't get a tribe of its own. Of course, he was the father of the priest. He was assigned 48 towns and the surrounding pasture lands of those towns, scattered all throughout Israel, north and south. We read in Numbers 35:2, "Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities." Dropping down 5 verses to Numbers 35, verse 7, "All the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities together with the pasture lands." This is also mentioned in Joshua 14:4, "For the sons of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and he did not give a portion to the Levites in the land except cities to live in with their pasture lands for their livestock and for their property." And then this is mentioned again in Joshua 21:41, "All the cities of the Levites in the midst of the possession of the sons of Israel were 48 cities with their pasture lands." Now, so there's a difference in the dispersion of the two tribes. Simeon, his tribe was ignominiously scattered, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, because they were gross idolaters, they say. I don't know how Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown know that. Levi, they were very anti-idolatrous because they were in charge of the priesthood, I suppose. They were honorably divided in Jacob. So I don't know if you can really say there was retribution for that murder that Levi helped commit with Simeon. That's not the way it worked out. I won't try to justify that one way or the other. Sometimes it's hard to see justice in history. Is real hard. We go now to Genesis 49, 8 through 12. "Judah, your brothers shall praise you." So now Jacob, in doing his blessing, he's moved from Reuben to Simeon to Levi. He's already done in the previous chapter Ephraim and Manasseh, which is Joseph. Joseph is son number 11. So now he's starting back at the top. 1, 2, 3, and now Judah's number 4. "Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. Now, this is not, on the surface, all that easy to interpret, so we've got to go through this. First of all, let's note some incidental details. The NIV Study Bible points out that Judah and Joseph were given the longest blessings. Joseph's blessings was for his sons Ephraim and Manasseh, took up all of chapter 48. And this one right here is fairly long also. And as it turns out, Judah was to lead the southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and Joseph, through Ephraim, was going to rule the northern tribes. So the two blessings, the two prophecies with the that were the longest, those were the tribes that end up with the most power. Now, Judah is assigned leadership. As we've already said many times in these audios, he was the son of Leah, Leah's fourth son, Jacob's fourth son. And his personal leadership all through the story of Genesis, he negotiated with Jacob about, please, father, let's take Benjamin back to Egypt or we're going to die. He negotiated with Joseph and said, please let me be a slave instead of Benjamin so Benjamin can go back home to Jacob. He was the guy that did the talking for the brothers, and likewise, his tribe became a leader in Israel also. Now, we need to mention Joseph. I don't think I did this in last audio. He's getting all this great double portion through his sons. He was thrown into a pit and sold into slavery, and yet he ended up higher than all of them. He got the double portion. He got the inheritance. He got the birthright. Now, Judah, of course, as you probably know, means praise. Judah's your brother shall praise you. That's a reference to the meaning of Judah, which the Hebrew, well, the Hebrew might not precisely mean praise. The NIV note says it's the Hebrew word sounds like and may be derived from the Hebrew for praise. That's close enough. So we just say it means praise. And then Jacob says that Judah, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Now that was fulfilled in David, who was from the tribe of Judah. Psalm 18:40, thou hast also given me the necks of mine enemies, that I might destroy them that hate me. Of course, David wiped out a lot of the surrounding enemies of Israel, Ammon, Moab, so forth, Philistines. So that's true. Judah's hand is on the neck of the enemies through Judah's descendant, David. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Bow down, that means that all of the other brothers shall acknowledge Judah as the leader, as we've already said. I've mentioned it just in passing, but let me read you the scriptures. Genesis 43:3. Judah spoke to Jacob, saying, the man solemnly warned us, you shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. That's when Judah is negotiating with his father Jacob. Please let Benjamin go back to Egypt. Same chapter, chapter 43, verses 8-10. Judah said to his father, Israel, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever. And so there, Judah says, I'll be responsible. You can take it out on me. I'll be surety for the return of Benjamin. Then we go to Genesis 44. This is when Judah and the brothers are in Joseph's house. Judah is mentioned first for Genesis 44, verse 14. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, they fell to the ground before him. Joseph was still there, and the brothers fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, what is this deed that you have done? Talking about the silver cup in the bag, in Benjamin's bag. And so Judah said, what can say, my Lord? How can we justify ourselves? So he was the one that, and then he said, let me finish here. He says, God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves. And then he says in verse 33 and verse 34, please let your servant remain. Let me, Judah, remain instead of Benjamin as a slave. So we see that Judah is now the spokesman, and we also see Judah given prominence in the Exodus, the tribe of Judah, not Judah himself. Of course, he's dead by then. Numbers 10:14, the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah, according to their armies, set out first with Nashon, the son of Amminadab, over its army. So the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah, according to their armies, set out first. They were first to go. And later on, all the other tribes would submit to Judah when David and Solomon ruled Israel from Judah. That was before the kingdom split. So that prophecy came to pass. That prophecy that said that your father's son shall bow down to you. And then in verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. A whelp is just a lion's cub. And so Judah is like a lion that eats his prey. He couches, he crouches down, he springs and and so forth. That just refers to Judah's power and majesty, as all lion metaphors do. It's a symbol of sovereignty, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, Israel, not Judah in particular, but Israel as a whole, is often later depicted as a lion. Ezekiel 19:1 through 7, "As for you, take up a lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, 'What was your mother? A lioness among lions. She lay down among young lions. She reared her cubs. When she brought up one of her cubs, he became a lion, and he learned to tear his prey. He devoured men.'" I could go on, but you see what I'm saying there, that Israel is like a lion. Micah 5:8, "The remnant of Jacob will be among the nations, among many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest." Jacob, of course, is Israel. "Like a young lion among flocks of sheep, which if he passes through, tramples down and tears, and there is none to rescue." So there, Israel, or the remnant of Israel, the remnant of Jacob, is compared to a lion. Numbers 24:9, "He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who dares rouse him." So Israel as a whole is compared to a lion, and we know that Jesus himself was called the Lion of Judah. So the tribe of Judah is like a lion, and Jesus, the descendant of Judah, is also called a lion. Revelation 5:5, "And one of the elders said to me, 'Stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, is overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals,'" referring to Jesus. Now in verse 10, the text reads, "Jacob continues and says, 'The scepter shall not depart from Judah.'" What is a scepter? That's an iron rod that symbolizes kingly authority. The king would hold that rod between his feet and say, and everybody would look at that and say, "Oh, that's the king. He has power." Well, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah. Judah will rule." And of course, that's referring not to the individual Judah. That's talking about the tribe of Judah. Tribe will rule. Now, this scepter, this ruling, was initially fulfilled in David. Numbers 24:17, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come forth from Jacob. A scepter shall rise from Israel and shall crush through the forehead of Moab and tear down the sons of Sheth." Sons of Sheth were possibly the early inhabitants of Moab. John Gill says they are known as the Shutu people in ancient Egyptian documents, and that's referring to King David. He says, "A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall rise from Israel." David, he's going to smash, and David was well known for smashing Moab. That's the initial fulfillment. Of course, ultimately, that's fulfilled in Christ, because Jesus holds the throne of David, and so he has the scepter. He rules as the king in the spiritual kingdom, the kingdom of God. And all this is in house of Judah, and Jacob predicted that precisely accurately. "Now this scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes." Now that is a strange phrase, "until Shiloh comes." There was a town called Shiloh. In fact, that's where the first tabernacle was set up in Israel. It's a town, actually, but that's not what we're talking about here. This is the only place in the Old Testament where Shiloh is mentioned that's not a town or not a geographic region. The translation is difficult. I'll give you 6 options. The NIV suggests, "until he comes to whom it belongs." So the iron scepter will be between the king's feet until he comes to whom it belongs. Well, that would be the Messiah. Or it could be "until Shiloh comes." That's what we have here. That doesn't mean too much. Or the NIV note says it can mean "until he comes to whom tribute belongs." Well, that would be the Messiah. Now, gotquestions.org says it can be translated as "the peaceful or prosperous one." So the scepter shall remain between the feet of the king of Judah the scepter shall indicate the rulership of Judah, of the tribe of Judah, until the peaceful or prosperous one comes. Again, the Messiah. John Gill says the word comes from a root, Shiloh, comes from a root which means quiet, peaceable, and prosperous. Another possible translation, according to James Fawcett and Brown and gotquestions.org, is Shiloh means the sent. So the scepter shall be in the tribe of Judah until the sent one comes. Well, that's the Messiah. Or until the seed comes. Again, Jameson Foster Brown at gotquestions.org says that Shiloh can be translated as the seed. So, however you translate it, or whatever its original meaning is, it obviously refers to the Messiah. So, David, here's a messianic prediction that the Messiah would come in the tribe of Judah through David, who lived in Bethlehem, where Jesus was born. Jesus is the Lion of Judah. "And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Now, of course, that was all initially fulfilled in David, but ultimately in the spiritual kingdom of God, all the people in the church will be in obedience to Jesus. Now, verse 11 reads like this, "He ties his foal to the vine." It's talking about Judah. not talking about Shiloh. It's not talking about the Messiah. It's talking about Judah. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. Now, I say that. A lot of people like to say that refers to Jesus, but I don't think it makes a lot of sense here as we keep going. He washes his garments in wine. That's Judah. And his robes in the blood of grapes. That's Judah. His eyes are dull from wine. That's Judah, not the Messiah. When is the Messiah's eyes dull from wine? And his teeth white from milk. When is Jesus' teeth white from milk? So that's why I say it's all this refers to Judah. Now let's see how it refers to Judah. He ties his foal to the vine. Judah is so prosperous that its vines were strong enough to support tying an ass to them. Normally you don't tie an ass to a grapevine. You tie it to a tree. But there's so many vines that you can tie an ass to them. That's John Gill says that. Ellicott says that Judah's land was so rich in vineyards that the traveler would tie his ass to the vine because the trees were abundant and were everywhere. Same idea. Cambridge Commentary for Bibles and Schools says that vines are so abundant in Judah that the vine stem would be used for tying up animals, even though normally vine stems are protected from animals. You don't want your animals chewing on your vines, obviously, but there's so many of them. Who cares? Tie them up. We don't care if we wreck a few vines. We got so much because Judah is loaded with prosperity. Now, I said that this does not refer to the Messiah. I'm opposing some heavy hitters here. Martin Luther, the church fathers, they say that these words are an allegory referring to Christ, and these words do not refer to the tribe of Judah. And here's how the argument goes. They say, look, Judah is just said by Jacob to be warlike, like a lion, but riding on an ass is a symbol of peace, and therefore, this must refer to Shiloh through the Messiah, the peaceful one, like on Palm Sunday when Jesus came in on an ass. Well, Kyle and Delich argue against that, and they say, look, there's nothing contradictory with a warrior wanting peace. Just because Judah's like a lion and fights like a lion, that doesn't mean he doesn't want peace. And besides, the distinction between asses as referring to peace and horses as referring to war was a distinction which was made much later in history, mainly because there weren't any horses in Israel at this time. So I hate to disagree with such big shots like Martin Luther and the church fathers, but I really think that just refers to Judah. But I report, you decide. All right. Judah ties his foal to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. That's just the Hebrew way of repeating the same thing twice. He washes his garments in wine. And that means normally you wash your garments in water, but if you're going to wash them in wine, that means wine is as plentiful as water and wine is cheap. It's cheap when you got a lot of money. You can afford to buy a lot of wine. So again, it's a symbol of prosperity. The people who say this refers to Jesus, I think what they say is the wine is like blood and he washes his garments in blood as he's conquering the blood of his foes, as he conquers his foes. The NIV Study Bible agrees with me and says that wine refers to a settled and prosperous life that Judah's descendants would someday enjoy. John Gill, on the other hand, says, no, this refers to the crucifixion of Christ. He washes his garments in wine, means his garments are washed in blood when he's crucified. Adam Clark says, no, it doesn't refer to Jesus' blood. It refers to the blood of Christ's enemies as he overcomes them, metaphorically. Let me read Clark's quote. The vengeance to be then inflicted on all the enemies of his church, or congregation of faithful Christians, is expressed by the symbolical imagery of washing his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes, which, to understand literally, would be incongruous and unusual anywhere, while it aptly represents his garments crimson in the blood of his foes and their immense slaughter, an imagery frequently adopted in the prophetic scriptures. Well, that sounds real good, and it is true. You normally don't wash your clothes in wine, but if it's a metaphor showing abundance, that's the same thing as saying it's a metaphor showing victories over your enemies. But again, that's somebody else's opinion. I don't happen to hold to it. Again, I'll report that one and you can decide. We go now to verse 12. Either the tribe of Judah or the Messiah, Shiloh, is said to be characterized this way in verse 12, Genesis 49. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk. Now, to me, this is the clincher that shows that this is referring to Judah. Judah is so prosperous and has so much wine. And has so much wine and drinks so much that his eyes become dull. Now again, I can't see Jesus the Messiah getting drunk on wine. Well, here's what John Gill does to try to make it refer to Jesus. Quote, as applied to the Messiah, the antitype of Judah and who was of this tribe, it may denote not so much the beauty of his eyes as the joy and pleasure that sparkled in his eyes when he shed his blood on the cross. Oh, please. Joy and pleasure that sparkled in his eyes. He was undergoing horrible agony. enduring that and despising the shame of it for the joy of the salvation of his people, or the clearness of his sight in beholding the action of his enemies. It says his eyes will be dull. How does that refer to clearness of sight? It said his eyes will be dull. How does that refer to joy on the cross as he dies? Or the clearness of his sight, or the fierceness and fury of his wrath against his enemies. Does that sound dull? The fierceness and fury of his wrath against them whose eyes are said to be flames of fire. That's not dull. Flames of fire is not dull, folks. I think John Gill has just completely proved my point without meaning to. It's referring to the fact that Judah is so prosperous that the tribe of Judah's eyes are dull with wine. He's sitting there. He's had a little too much because it's so abundant, the wine is. We go now to verse 13, Genesis 49. We move next to the next child. This is child number 5. Well, I say it's child number 5. It's Leah's fifth child, Zebulun and Issachar. It's not Leah, actually. It's Zebulun and Issachar, which belongs to Leah. We've skipped over the sons of the concubine, Zilpah. Zilpah had Gad and Asher, so they're skipped. And now we're still doing Leah's blood children, Leah's children, Leah's child number 5, Jacob's child number 9. Dan and Naphtali were born by Bilhah, and then Gad and Asher were born by Zilpah. And then Leah will now start with Issachar. Zebulun will dwell at the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. Well, you'll have to look at the map here. If you do look at the map, you will see that Zebulun is in the Esdraelon Valley, the Jezreel Valley, not quite at the seashore, about 10 miles away, right up there near Carmel on the Mediterranean coast. And if you go up the coast a little bit, you hit Tyre and you hit Sidon. And, of course, that Sidon is probably talking about the region of Sidon, not the city. The city's kind of way up there. But Sidon had, in fact, Tyre came out from Sidon, if I remember correctly. So Sidon was kind of had the whole area up there. And Zebulun is right near it. She'll be a haven of ships. And unfortunately, I don't have which commentator mentioned this, but I'm going to give it the quote from one of my commentators, though. Landlocked by the tribes of Asher and Manasseh, the descendants of Zebulun were close enough to the Mediterranean, within 10 miles, to feast on the abundance of the seas. In fact, in Deuteronomy 33, referring to Zebulun and also to Issachar, it says that they will draw out the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. So they did a seafood trade, even though they weren't directly on the river. In fact, the Kidron River was right south of Zebulun, was one of the borders of Zebulun. All they had to do was get on that river and they're hop, skip, and a jump away from the ocean. Now, again, remember, this is a prophecy. This is not the distribution of the land that put Zebulun there. It had nothing to do with Jacob. He's just predicting what's going to happen. It was all done by Lot. So Jacob had to have spoken by prophecy about doing this. That's why we call it a prophecy. We go now to Genesis 49:14-15. We go to Leah's child, her blood child, her sixth blood child, Issachar. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Now, Issachar is described by Easton's Illustrated Dictionary, and I'm going to go through this definition to pick up some points. It means hired, the word hired. God has given me, said Leah, my hire. In fact, let me read that verse for you in Genesis 30:18. Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my slave, my hire is old-fashioned English for my slave, and that would be Zilpah, her concubine, in other words. Well, not her concubine, but her handmaiden, her servant, her slave. God has rewarded me for giving my slave, and that's Zilpah, to my husband. And she named him Issachar, because Issachar means slave. Issachar was Jacob's ninth son. Issachar is said to be a strong donkey. The NIV has a raw-boned donkey. I like that translation pretty good there. NIV, raw-boned donkey. A raw-boned donkey who lies down between the sheepfolds. That word is hard to translate. It could be the saddlebags. NIV note has maybe it could be campfires, whatever. The point is Issachar is lying down. And it sounds like a donkey lying between the sheepfolds. It sounds like in that pastoral society, you got a strong donkey that's too lazy to do any work, just lies down. When he saw that a resting place was good and the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. So he wants to rest, he wants to lie down, but at the same time, he has to carry burdens and work at forced labor as a slave. Remember, Issachar means slave. So how do we explain this? Well, the Cambridge commentary says that bowed down, when it says he wanted to bow down, he was ready to kneel and bear any heavy burden for the sake of a quiet life and a fertile land. Now, how was Issachar's prophecy fulfilled? Ellicott says that Issachar was content to endure a great deal of injustice because their condition was prosperous. Remember, they are in the Valley of Jezreel right along with Zebulun, and that was the most fertile area of Israel. But Ellicott and Adam Clark say that what Issachar did was, we're too lazy to fight the Canaanites. We don't want to get involved in a war with them. We'll just submit to the Canaanites and pay their taxes, rather than exerting ourselves to drive out the old inhabitants like they were supposed to do. Adam Clark says most people believe that. And I looked at Ellicott and I looked at some other commentators, and they do seem to say that. So we'll assume that Issachar is too lazy to fight the Canaanites. He likes that lie down in green pastures up there. Now, Clark says this slave metaphor concerning Issachar has prejudiced our view of the tribe of Issachar. This is interesting. Let me quote this. Quote, the pusillanimity, can't pronounce that word, it means timidness, cowardice. The pusillanimity, which is generally attributed to this tribe, certainly does not agree with the view in which they are exhibited in Scripture. In the Song of Deborah, this tribe is praised for the powerful assistance which it then afforded. They are expressly said to have been valiant men of might in all their families and all their generations. This is in Judges 5. I.e., through every period of their history, it appears they were a laborious, hardy, valiant tribe, patient in labor and invincible in war, bearing both these burdens with great constancy whenever it was necessary. When Tola of this tribe judged Israel, the land had rest 23 years. Well, that does paint a different picture, does it not? We go to Genesis 49, verses 16 and 17. Dan shall judge his people. Now Jacob is going back to Bilhah's two children, Dan and Naphtali. Starting with Dan, Dan would be child number 5. First 4 to Leah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and then 2 for Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali, that's 6, and then 2 for Zilpah, Gad and Asher, that's 7 and 8, and then 2 for Leah, Zebulun and Issachar, that's 9 and 10, and then 2 more for Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin, 11 and 12. So Dan is number 5. Dan shall judge his people. Now the word Dan actually means to judge, as Adam Gill points out. The NIV translates it that way in their note. He provides justice. He shall judge his people. Now, judge has a negative connotation. Judges people could also mean provides justice for his people. That sounds a lot better. Now, who is the people that Dan is judging? Is he judging only the people in his tribe, in Dan's tribe, or all of Israel? Well, if it's talking about Dan shall judge his people, all of the tribes of Israel, that would have to refer to Samson, who was from the tribe of Dan. Samson, of course, at one time was the judge over all Israel. I'm not sure which way that goes. I don't think anybody really knows, but the point is Dan is a judge. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls. Now, we need to ask the question, why would Jacob mention as one of the tribes of Israel? Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Why does Dan have to be considered as one of the tribes of Israel? Well, of course, he's one of the tribes of Israel. Why even mention it? Well, it's because he's the first one in Jacob's blessing that was the son of a concubine and not the son of a true wife, Leah and Rachel. Dan, as I just mentioned, was the first of the concubine's son, Bilhah, Rachel's concubine. So Dan and the other concubine's sons, that's Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, they were to have equal rule of their tribes. Same kind of rule that the sons of Leah and Rachel were to have. Now, Dan is said to be like a serpent. A serpent implies subtlety and stratagem. How might this have been fulfilled? Let me give you three options. One, option one, Dan's members, the tribe of Dan's members, were the ringleaders in idolatry, which infected all of Israel. That's why he's like a serpent. This is the commentator Benson says this. And John Gill says that Dan not only affected his own tribe with that idolatry, the golden calf idolatry, but he affected the general disposition of the whole tribe. It's not just Samson and his idolatry, but the golden calves messed everybody up in Israel. Of course, Dan was the one that set the golden calf up, or the golden calf was set up by Jeroboam in the tribe of Dan, in the northern half of Dan. And so Dan is like a serpent because he led Israel into idolatry. That's option number one. Option number two, and this is the most preferred option, I believe, Dan showed treachery in taking the town of Laish. This is in Judges 18. I'm going to refer to three commentaries here. Cambridge Commentary, the NIV Study Bible, and Kyle and Delitch. This treachery, this serpent-like activity of the tribe of Dan refers to the treachery of a group of Danites later from the time of Jacob when they conquered Laish, the town. This is in Judges 18:27. Let me read this. After they had taken the gods Micah had made and the priests that belonged to him, they went to Laish, to a quiet and unsuspecting people. They killed them with their swords and burned the city. Now, how did they do that? They did it with cunning and strategy more than by valor and strength, says Adam Clark. I guess I need to tell you the story. They went to Micah's house. They found that Micah had bought a Levite priest, and they told the priest, hey, if you'll be the priest of a whole tribe of Dan, we'll make you richer than this one guy Micah can make you rich. And so the priest went out with him, and then this guy Micah, tracked the Danites down and said, hey, you just took my household gods. What are you doing? And the Danites said, well, what are you going to do about it? We're stronger than you. Now, I guess that would be crafty and sneaky. Saved having a battle, just steal the priest. Although it's not completely true that they didn't use strength and valor, as Adam Clark says, because in Judges 18:26 it says, the Danites went on their way, and Micah turned to go back home because he saw that they were stronger than he was. The Cambridge Dictionary says that Dan is dangerous to his foes by ambuscades, secret raids, and guerrilla warfare. I don't know about that. It sounds to me like people are making up some stuff here, or at least exaggerating a little bit. But if you read the story, it does sound like they snookered Micah, and having left there, they killed all the people in Laish. It seems to me the cunningness and the craftiness was done with Micah, but when they went to Laish, a quiet and unsuspecting people, they just killed him and burned the city. That doesn't sound very subtle to me. Now, there's another way to look at this. Instead of saying that the snake stands for craftiness, you could just say the snake stands for evil, because he bites the horse's heels, makes the rider fall. So he just beats people militarily. So not be so precise with the metaphor. And then that would fit Laish pretty good. But at any rate, that's option number two, that Jacob is referring in his prophecy to when Dan took Laish in Judges 18. Now here's option number three, all of Samson's activities. Remember, Samson is of the tribe of Dan. Here's what Delitch of Colin Delitch fame says, quote, romantic chivalry of the brave, gigantic Samson, when the cunning of the serpent, he overthrew the mightiest foes. The NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agree with that, too. They say Samson would single-handedly hold the Philistines at bay, and that shows craftiness and cunningness. And well, that's true. If you read the story of Samson, I'm sure you remember all those Samson stories. He was a foxy son of a gun. And so that might be the fulfillment of Dan's serpent-like craftiness as a horned snake in the path. The end of the metaphor here in verse 17, a snake that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls. That's what happens. You bite a horse's heel, the horse jumps up, and then that, of course, causes the rider to fall. Now, in verse 18, we see this, Genesis 49, for your salvation I wait, O Lord. And that's a strange thing to say right in the middle of blessing your sons or prophesying about your sons. It seems unconnected to what goes before or what comes after. Well, here's some options as to why Jacob said this. First option, Jacob pauses midway through his series of blessings to utter a brief prayer for God's help. That's the NIV Study Bible. Here's what Adam Clark says. These are not really, well, okay, here's option number two. Jacob, finding his spirits faint and flag, stops and breathes a while before he proceeded any further in blessing the tribes. And as he found he was a dying man and knew not how soon he should expire, expresses what he had been thoughtful of and concerned about in times past and still was. That's similar to option number one. He wants to stop and pray. He wants to stop because he's tired. Option number three, Jacob is looking for the Messiah. And so then he's just talked about Samson, assuming that's the correct version of Dan's being serpent-like. If he's referring to Samson there, he's saying, look, I'm not trying to get salvation like Samson's going to get. I'm waiting for your salvation, O Lord. Well, that assumes, that's Adam Clark's idea, but that assumes that Jacob knew how the prophecy of Dan was going to be fulfilled. I'm not sure he knew that. I just think he's taking a break and praying for the fulfillment of these prophecies. Ladies and gentlemen, with that, Genesis 49, verses 1 through 18 is finished. We'll take up the last half of Genesis 49 in our next audio. Jacob will continue blessing his sons. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.